It's time for Mac Geek Gab, and listener Tim brings us our quick tip of the week with this really cool one. Look, since math calculations are in the operating system, they're now available in text messages in Apple's latest OSs, iPad OS, iOS, Mac OS. They're all there. It's all there. Go try it. Enter your equation, and when you type the equal sign, you get an option to X out of the result, leaving just the equation that you typed, or you can hit the space bar, and the result of the equation will be typed for you. More tips like this, plus your questions answered today on the Mac Geek Gab number 1057 for Monday, September 30th, 2024.
Welcome to Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in tips like that. You send in questions. We answer the questions. We share the tips. We share cool stuff found. We string it all together into an agenda so that we each have an excellent opportunity to learn at least five new things every single time we get together here on International Podcast Day in Durham, New Hampshire. I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in South Dakota, I'm Adam Christensen.
And coming to you live from Pleasanton, California, it's Pilot Pete on show 1057, Hit and Run.
Yep, I was just wondering what our police code was.
It's one of two. It's either a hit and
missing
run
person.
Hit and run accident is what it says. I want to come back to that. And missing person, right. I whenever I see something on the highway that people would call an accident, oh, look, those two cars got into an accident. I don't know what anyone's intentions were. I'm just driving by. How do I know it was an accident versus something intentional? So I call it an incident. Not an accident. It's an incident.
Or a crash.
Yes, right.
It is a crash. Intention is not determined.
That's right. Intention is not necessarily obvious. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, we
cast no asparagus here, though.
We cast no asparagus. We do cast giveaways. This month, if you go to MacGeekGab.com/giveaway, you will see our giveaway for OneFocus, which is a fantastic app, and it lasts one more day, this giveaway, at least from the time that this episode releases. Of course, if you're watching the live stream, you get a few more days noticed, but I don't know why it's showing zero entries. I know that's not true. However, it's because I have no entries on this computer. That's why it's showing me 50. Zero entries. Yeah, there's 50. So you got some time. Go enter. They are giving away five licenses to this OneFocus app, which is a great app for pulling together pulling aside everything and really helping you focus and pull, not like it keeps you from using apps that you don't want to be using in those moments. It's fantastic. So happy to partner with them for this month's giveaway. Shall we keep going with tips about the Apple OS there, Adam? Apple OS?
Yeah, some hidden features that you may not have caught in the new operating systems. This one's for iOS 18, iPad OS 18, I'm assuming, as well. Comes from Martin. Martin says, rather than pressing the side buttons to get to the screen, to the screen to turn off your iPhone completely, so that's, you know, the slider to turn it off, there's now a new power button in the upper right-hand corner of the control center, which you can use to get to the off screen. So if you pull down control center, I played with this because it's a great tip. Pull it down way up in the upper like right-hand corner. There's a little power button. You just press and hold that, and it will go to the off screen. So you don't have to remember the stupid finger gymnastics of volume up, volume down, you know, or whatever to activate the power on off screen. I guess that's the reset procedure. Power on off, you can just hold the side button, right? The power button.
Yeah.
The on off button.
So, yeah.
But at least it's there. WatchOS has this too. That's
oh, cool.
Yeah. What a novel concept to give people a software button to do this. I had been to the control center countless times, of course, since I'd been using iOS 18. I've been on the betas for probably a month now. Never noticed this there. Not
hidden right there in plain sight, is it?
Plain sight.
Yep.
So I learned something new. Yeah, absolutely. So, that's a good one.
Well, and the thing that Adam referred to here is the other quick tip, because I had this happen to me once. My phone froze. I couldn't do anything with it. I actually wound up going to the Apple store. This is years ago now, but he was talking about it. If it freezes, you have to hit the volume up, the volume down, then press and hold the power button, and it will reset. That's how you kind of control alt delete your iPhone. And a good tip to know when, because you can't get to the control center software when it's frozen on you.
I'll say it again for the people in the back. Up, down, power. I remember UDP because I'm a network nerd. You hit up, you hit down, you hit up, you release it, you hit down, you release it, and then you hold the power button, I believe, is the...
right, yep. Until you see the white Apple logo.
That's right.
And then you know you're saved.
Yeah, you've been saved. That's right. Doug reminds us to not forget about iOS 18's iPhone mirroring. He says, it works wonderfully. I use it regularly now. Last night, my battery was almost dead on my iPhone. I plugged it in about 10 feet away and used iPhone mirroring on my laptop to interact with the phone. I have a couple of messaging programs that do not have Mac or web equivalents, so I can use my keyboard and mouse, whereas I used to have to peck away at the phone keyboard. There are a few things that don't work properly. I think they might have to do with security, but in general, it works great. Thank you for that, Doug. I completely forgot that that was a feature in iOS 18. And
you haven't played with that yet.
Yeah, exactly. There's so many things that we hear about, and then it's like, if it's not...
Didn't you have to be like a developer using Xcode to get an iPhone screen up and try to do all that back in the day?
And that was only then, wired up. Apple were the only ones that had access to, like, they would do it for keynotes. They'd be like, hey, that feature you're demoing there, can we have that too? You know?
Right.
Yep. Yep.
A feature you didn't even know you wanted.
Yes.
Or,
yeah. I knew I wanted it.
They didn't know we wanted it. They didn't know we wanted it. Yeah.
That's the one. Yep. And then Taryn reminds us that when we talked about all the new tech and why we wanted the new phones and this, that, and the other thing in our keynote sort of debrief episode, he says, I'm surprised that no one called out the spatial or 3D camera feature, which is in all of the iPhones 16. He says, I want a new iPhone just for this function. I have a 10-year-old daughter. She still has four grandparents, and I want to get all of them on spatial videos and photos ASAP. I did the Apple Vision Pro Tour this summer, and while I don't have a plan to buy this now, looking to the future, having a 3D picture of the grandparents would be an amazing thing. He says, so I totally agree. Like that, totally forgot about that. Yep. Have you, Adam, you didn't forget about it though, did you?
No, I haven't actually taken a spatial photo or video with my new iPhone 16 Pro yet.
Okay.
But we did talk about, and John wrote in this week about how the spatial videos, like conversion in Apple Photos on Vision Pro is amazing. Like it is a killer feature of the, for sure, of the Vision Pro. So bringing that up just quickly, we talked about it when we talked about the new iOS features in a previous episode. And then this week, I found another killer app that I just want to throw out there. So I'm kind of circumventing CSF, but Beat Punch Fun and Fitness is a new app for the Vision Pro. And it's like a boxing kind of app to music. So it's a rhythm game, I guess, but it's also a fitness app and it does like fitness tracking. It has rings that look like Apple's health rings, but I haven't figured out if it ties into health yet or not. I can't figure out how that works, but I mean, it's so good that I paid. It is free to download and try out, but then there's also a subscription that adds additional features, including being able to use your own Apple Music library for some of the songs and stuff like that. So I wanted to be able to tie it in. I paid that. It's $34.99 a year.
Wow. Oh, okay.
Which
right,
isn't too bad.
No.
Yeah, no, a year for these additional features. And again, you can use it without paying the subscription. So it's an option. You can opt in to get additional features. But basically, I mean, it puts like virtual robot hands on your hands, and then they're overlaid with like these colored boxing gloves, and it's fully immersive and just super fun. Like, it's great, and you're getting some exercise, so that's good for me too. I figured $34 a year for basically, you know, that's cheaper than that's about a 1 month gym membership a lot of places, I think.
Yeah. So. Yeah, that's that. You're right. Oh, that's yeah. You're way ahead of the game. I mentioned on a previous episodes that my wife has been using her latest gen MetaQuest for exercise, and it's amazing. Like she loses herself in it. It, you know, it's not like, yep, I need to exercise for 30 minutes today. It's I have to set an alarm so that I stop after 30 minutes. And one of the apps that she will occasionally use, not maybe for exercise, like it, you do work up a sweat. It's called Drunken Bar Fight. And it's basically, you know, the same thing that you're talking about here, just in a potentially a different context. But yeah.
Yeah. What I'll say about this one is the like mapping to the hands, all the developers and people are saying like that's a problem.
Yeah.
Whatever this developer did, they figured it out, because it does a great job without actual controllers.
Yeah.
So, and even better, like the other kind of killer app, although it wasn't a very long experience, is the What If from Disney, which is a whole Marvel. You basically become Doctor Strange, and you do all the kinds of gestures and things like that. The hand tracking on that was not nearly as good as what it is on this one. So if anybody's looking for a fun thing to check out, Beat Punch Fun and Fitness on your Vision Pro.
All right. Yeah, and there will be links in the show notes for all of these things. Of course, last week before we recorded, before my new iPhone 16 had arrived, and I was lamenting the fact that I was on the 18.1 beta, knowing full well that my phone was going to come with some flavor of 18.0, and that was going to likely mean this convoluted thing, blah, blah, blah. I couldn't have been more wrong, and I couldn't have been happier to have been wrong. As listener John points out, I also was in the 18.1 beta and just tried to go straight to migrate on my new phone, and it worked. It took care of the update, and it was really easy. He says, I hope you found that before the pain. Indeed, I did. I figured I would try and see what happened. And it asked me, it said, you're in the developer beta. Do you want to keep doing that? Of course, I chose to answer yes. And it was like, great. I'm going to install 18.1 beta 4, which is what it was at the moment. Now we're up to beta 5. And then it rebooted the phone and it said, okay, great. Now just do your migration from phone to phone, and psh, good to go. And it's been great ever since. So, yeah. Cool. Thank goodness. I know.
How stable have the developer betas been? Because I'm on the public beta and I've thought about switching. But
super stable. I've been on the 18.1 betas since they came out because I wanted access to as much of the AI features as I could have. So normally I don't run the beta past the 0.0 release. But obviously this one, my plan is once we hit 0.1 to stop on the betas. But if 0.2 has more AI feature, I'm going to stay with it. And I am scratching the surface of what I can do with the AI features in this beta. And it's game changing. It's truly game changing. So,
yeah.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Cool. Yeah. So Craig has a quick tip for us. For those folks who have the iPad and Magic keyboards, he says, I have a new iPad Pro 13-inch M4 with a Magic keyboard. I love using it this way, as it's as an iPad is supposed to be or intended to be used, and it works great. Until Saturday, the spacebar was driving me nuts, not spacing, doing strange things on the screen, practically unusable. A little searching, and I found that there was a potential solution. Go into Settings, Keyboard, Full Keyboard Access, Commands, and look under Activate. See if your spacebar is listed there. If so, select None and try again. Mine has been behaving exactly as it's supposed to at this point. Hope this helps someone. Yeah, I have no idea how he would have gotten that turned on, but that would have been infuriating, I would imagine. So if your Magic Keyboard spacebar is misbehaving, check this out.
Nice. Kirit has a bit of an idea, and I think we all liked it. He says, I don't want to presume anything about the structure of your show. Please, this is our thing that we all do together here. It's like, sure, we drive the bus because somebody has to drive the bus, but like, your ideas are arguably more important than ours. So please keep them coming too. Feedback@MacGeekGab.com. That's the important place.
You heard him. Feedback@MacGeekGab.com, because when we didn't think of it, none of us could believe it.
Pete, I wasn't paying attention. Was that feedback@MacGeekGab.com?
It's what he said.
It is. So Kirit's idea. Since you already have great segments like Quick Tips, QT, in the agenda, and Cool Stuff Found, CSF, in the agenda, I was thinking you could introduce another segment called Don't Get Caught, DGC, if you like the idea. And he had some stories about this. But yeah, I mean, when we share PSAs or warnings or whatever, how have we not thought to call that the Don't Get Caught segment?
Right?
Well, that's why you're here with us, folks, because you're the ones that come up with the best ideas. So the next few things fall into Don't Get Caught. All right. Wait a minute. I have a thing here. Here it is. Ready? Oh, well, I did it.
Dave, no one wants to see your thing.
I know, but we're going to do it anyway. Right. Thanks, Pete.
Don't get caught.
Now, amen. Now, we're properly prepared. Amen. Yeah, there you go. That's right. Play ball.
All right. Well, Steve has a way for us to not get caught. Steve says, I was planning to update my old iPhone SE 2 to iOS 17.7 on Monday, September 16th, but iOS 18 jumped to the head of the line. I tried to get out of iOS 18 update, but was unable to figure out how. So I went ahead and started iOS 18 update. I got to the point of downloading 18, but my phone said I had no space on it. I found out I had about 70% in documents. I didn't know what that was, but it said it was purgeable. I couldn't find a way to delete it. I went to iMazing to see if this would help, but again, I couldn't figure out how to delete it. Then I thought maybe I could use iMazing to update to 18. With my iPhone connected to my MacBook Pro, I started the update. Again, the update would not complete. Then I said, oh well, I can restore my backup from iMazing. But oh no, my backup was damaged and I could not repair it. So the only thing left I could think of was to wipe it, install 18, and try and rebuild my phone back to where it was. I spent most of the day installing all the apps that I could remember I had on my phone. I was at my fiance's house for a couple days. I returned to my house and checked my Mac Mini and found a backup that was about 6 months old. I restored the phone and it brought back all the apps, many that I had forgot about. Fun thing, many of the apps that I forgot about didn't have their icon. It was a gray box with a circle and an X, but they worked fine. After a couple days, the icons came back. Sorry my description of my problem was so long, but I thought you should know. Lessons learned. I guess I should check my backups to see that they are good and current. If you have any thought on what I should do next time, please let me know. I'll try to remember them so I don't get caught. All right, so I do get caught again? I think he means don't get caught again.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. Yeah. Really
well, that
good
was gonna be my advice. What should you do next time? Don't get caught.
Don't get caught.
Check your backups.
Yeah, check your backups before you upgrade. And one thing he didn't mention in there was iCloud backups, which may have been current. And may still be current. Your old phone might still be floating out there in your iCloud backups. So,
well, that might be the also don't get caught, because I know there are people out there that still don't use iCloud backups.
Yeah, man.
Right? They're so, and I could be wrong. They're kind of incremental, right? I mean, the when you do a backup yesterday and then you do one again today, if yesterday was a full backup, it just does the changes today.
I'm pretty sure it does. They're
That's
pretty
correct.
Quick. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, they're pretty quick. Yeah, yeah.
I think storage is the thing. You know, a lot of people, and a big chunk of this, I'm sorry, is on Apple. Their storage prices, like their memory prices, are ridiculous. They need to have a think. Obviously, it's a profit center for them. So, you know, there's a give and take there. But, I mean, come on.
Yeah. Yep. I agree.
And what I read this week, third of their income is going to be services.
Yeah.
By the end of the year.
We knew this. Yeah. We knew this.
Yeah. Which is brilliant. There on. Good on them. But
I'm paying them almost $40 a month now for, you know, the Apple One subscription with 2.2 terabytes of storage for the family or whatever. I mean,
I don't even want to tell you how much I'm paying in AppleCare subscriptions now.
I haven't moved to the month to month thing on most of my stuff. I probably will either do it or rue the day that I chose not to, but yes.
Well, especially if you're not upgrading your devices as frequently. Like, it was fine when I had a new phone every couple years, but if I'm going to be keeping my phone for 3 to 5 years, you know, when it has a problem in year four, I'm probably going to be happy I have it.
Yeah, but is that the time to upgrade?
You can't stop and add it later.
I know.
Maybe.
Yeah. I know. That's the thing. Is it? We have found in our family. Hang on.
Hey, well, my house is on fire. Let me get some insurance quick.
Yeah. So I had to knock on some wood, but we have found in our family that our experiences and use of our and abuse of our iPhones, and we all have varying levels of that. When I do a regression analysis on it, it has been less expensive to pay for the repairs, to essentially self-insure, than it has been to pay for the insurance. And I do this regression test every, you know, few years just to make sure. Really, I do it after we've had an issue. You know, somebody breaks the back glass or something, you know, happens, and it's like, all right, what would it cost us? Yep, okay, we're still way ahead of the game. Okay, but stay the course. So, I don't know.
That's actually a good don't get caught, and I'm going to take that advice and kind of go back and evaluate now that I am have been paying these subscriptions and look at how much am I paying versus, because I haven't done a repair in a long time. Your point's valid. So another don't get caught.
Yep. Yeah, there you go. Right. It fits in the segment. You got one from Paul, Pete?
I do. Paul wrote in, and I just realized I've got a question about this at the end, so there's going to be some good discussion. But he writes in, hi, this is a warning for everyone that uses the MAC address in their DHCP server to assign an IP address. After upgrading my M2 Mac Mini to Sequoia, the MAC address was changed from that which it had with Sonoma to something completely new. This also happened on my iPad. Both devices had private Wi-Fi address option set to fixed. The new MAC addresses meant that the Mac and the iPad did not get the IPs that I had specified and consequently did not follow the IP-based firewall rules I had set in my router, a potentially serious security problem. This led to some initial head-scratching, but once I entered the new MAC addresses into my DHCP server, everything was back to normal. On a separate but perhaps related issue, I run two Wi-Fi networks with distinct SSIDs, one for me and one for my guests. On my devices, I had auto-join set on my network and not set for the guest network. This meant that my devices never connected to the guest network unless I specifically forced them. During the OS upgrades, some of my devices, including the Mac Mini and iPad, seemed to forget the auto-join setting and ended up connecting to the guest network, probably because it came first alphabetically. Huh. These issues were easy to fix, but I don't recall having these sorts of issues with previous major upgrades. I hope these observations help others. And I wrote him back. I'm one of those people. I'm very directive with where my devices are so that I know if I needed to hit Debbie's iMac. I know exactly what IP address it's on. I know, and so, yeah, I haven't gone back. I wasn't home when I read this. So when I get home, I'm going to go back and look and see if any of this has changed, particularly on this computer, which I've upgraded to Sequoia.
15. macOS 15, yeah, Pete.
15. macOS 15. There you go. Bingo. That's the way to do it. Numbers from here on out.
It is.
But my question is that I didn't realize I had until we were reading this pre-show. I thought a MAC address was a hardware-based. I mean, I know you can spoof, but isn't that a hardware-based thing? Isn't that encoded into the...
You want to take this,
yes,
Adam? Yeah.
No, it is. Yeah, I mean, is it different? Am I missing something?
Yeah.
Well, perhaps. So Apple has this option on Wi-Fi where you can turn on, and this is there on the Mac, it's there on the phones, the iPads, all of the devices.
Where I know where you're going.
For each specific Wi-Fi network, you can turn on, and I believe it's on by default, or turn off, this option for private Wi-Fi address. And what that does is it spoofs, to your point, Pete, the MAC address of your device, and you can have it. I believe there's two options. There's fixed and like rotating or something. The idea is you don't want people to be able to fingerprint you as you move around. Yeah. The MAC address is not identifiable as this is an iPhone, this is a Mac or whatever. And it works great. Like, and on public networks, who cares, right? Just let the thing do what it wants. But for my home network, I turn that option off so that my network is getting that actual MAC address of the device all the time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So
there you go. So I clicked on the little quarter shaped pie, pulled up my Wi-Fi settings.
Yep.
And sure enough, private Wi-Fi address, your options are rotating, fixed, or off. And using a private Wi-Fi address helps reduce tracking of your Mac by Wi-Fi network operators. A rotating private address reduces tracking on this network and across other networks.
Yep.
I'm trying to remember. I can't find the setting. I know with my devices, when I did my mapping, I used the like ID. I forget what it's called. And I don't forget where you set that. So when I set my like router up and my mapping, I do it by the name of the thing, which is assigned to the physical MAC address. I don't know if that would help in this case.
No, because your router almost certainly is doing DHCP reservations by the MAC address that it sees. So, and you could choose, say, on your home network to use a fixed private address. And then as long as it's the same on that network all the time, you'll get the same, that your DHCP reservations will work and everything's fine. It's the rotating one. And it seems like, and I can't speak to this personally, but it seems like from what Paul's saying, at least, that whatever algorithm Apple was using to generate the fixed address for any given network changed or got reset. And so he no longer had the same fixed IP or fixed MAC address. And then his DHCP reservations got broken. So
cool.
Yep.
I had no idea that was there. That's awesome. You know,
while we're here and talking about DHCP reservations, I want to mention something, and we'll go much deeper into this in future episodes. But I have changed my main router on my network here, which is it's kind of a big deal. Like, I've been using Synology routers as my gateways for a long time. Most recently was on the RT6600AX. We do know that Synology has lots of products in the pipeline for 2025, way more than 2024. That's what they've told me. I don't know what those are. So I can't guess as to whether one of those is a router or not. I'm hoping one is, and I'm hoping that router has more than just one 2.5 gig Ethernet port. Because with all the fiber connections that are out there that are doing faster than gigabit Ethernet, or, you know, faster than gigabit, you need more than one. You need to be able to get gigabit Ethernet into your gateway router and then out of it, or multi-gigabit in and out. Mm. And the Synology router, the best one they have, only has one 2.5 gig Ethernet port. The rest are all 1 gig Ethernet ports. And with that, I started thinking maybe it's time to start messing with other routers and experimenting with other nerdy routers so that we have a suitable replacement to recommend. So I am experimenting with the Unify Cloud Gateway Max, and it's running great. The user interface is, of course, different from the Synology, equally as easy and confusing. Like, it's all this, it's all the same. You know, like, you're running a nerdy router, you kind of expect to have some nerdy things in there. All the features that I was running in the past are there, including inbound VPN. But I just wanted to kind of pave the way for future conversations. I've only been running this for a few days, 2 days here now. All has been good. All has been great.
I was able to VPN right in. That worked.
Yeah, sounds that like all worked. That up. It's all good. So I'm just sharing that, and then we'll talk more about it in.
Well, dare I ask what the price point is on it?
Yeah, it's relatively inexpensive. The Unify Cloud Gateway Max is $199, and I'm assuming comes, and all of the Ethernet ports on it are 2.5 gig Ethernet ports, and it works great.
It looks like the old Apple AirPort.
Yeah, it's that size. It's very small. Yeah, it's got four LAN ports and one WAN port. It has no Wi-Fi in it. I am using this with my Eero's. Yes, I do also have a U7 Pro, which is their Wi-Fi 7 access point, which for $189 is way less. You know, you get a couple of these for way less than you'd be paying for Eero Wi-Fi 7s or any of that. So anyway.
Yep.
even the U7 Pro Max is only $279. So yeah, there's a lot. But right now I'm basically using it with my Eero setup.
Yeah. I was just going to add my Orbi Wi-Fi 6 system was way more expensive than all that.
Yeah, and the Wi-Fi 7 stuff just, you know, make your eyes bleed when you look at the prices. So, yavol. Hey, speaking of things that make your eyes bleed, I don't know about that transition, Dave, but I read something about an electronics travel restriction in Mexico. Now, so if you are traveling to Mexico, and I believe this is somewhat new, I don't know for certain when this was instituted, but when entering Mexico, they have, as does every country, they have restrictions on what you can bring in before it starts counting as like goods that you are bringing in for sale and therefore must pay an import duty on them, right? So the thing that you still can bring four fishing poles, everything's good there, a pair of binoculars, two cameras, you can bring three cell phones per person, all is good there. One problem is that you can bring one portable computer, laptop, tablet, or similar computing device, e.g. an iPad. One. So you can't bring a laptop and an iPad. You can bring one or the other. Yep. Otherwise, they will charge you a 19%, you know, import duty on the value of one of those devices. Guess which one they're going to pick. So,
oh, yeah, not the lesser of the two.
That's correct. So,
you ever fly to Mexico, Pete?
We do. And we have to write all that, all Korea, China, all these countries. We go, I have a watch, I have an iPad, I have a laptop. They expect you to write it all down.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
And then, now, knock wood, as crew, I've never been tapped for any of that.
Sure.
But yeah, they.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just remember, Constitution doesn't apply over there. You don't have any Fourth Amendment or Fifth Amendment rules. So.
No, you're not in the United States anymore. But you're right.
You're not in Kansas anymore.
Yeah,
Toto.
Yeah, nowhere near. So I'll put a link in the show notes to the page that I plan to check in January before I go to Mexico in February.
Yeah, now, that's disconcerting.
They don't check everyone on the way in. Lots of people had said, oh, I do this. It's no problem. Well,
yeah.
Right. It's no
until
problem
it is.
Until you get caught. Maybe I should have included in the don't get caught. Oh, this is the don't get caught segment.
We're still here. Don't get caught.
Yeah.
Don't get caught in Mexico.
Don't get caught.
Too many computers and iPads.
That's right. Yeah.
It's not a problem until it is.
Yep. So...
Yep.
Yeah, but what if somebody in one of the comments on Facebook, which is where I learned about this initially, but I did confirm it on the Mexican consulate website or something. But one person said, "Do they make electronic fishing poles?" And so I replied, "Yes, mine looks like an iPad because I can bring four fishing poles in." So you know, there you go. All right, shall we move on?
All right. Yeah. So buckle up, because you guys today, I guess, gave me all the novels, but Kirit has one for us, and he says, "Hello, I've got a story to share about that may save you from a little pitfall, literally and figuratively. So I just got my shiny new iPhone 16 Pro Max, and while I was setting it up, I had a problem that I'd like to share. Apple has made transferring data to your new iPhone a breeze these days, mostly. There's just one tiny catch that you should know about, and here's the scoop. As a habit, I always back up my old iPhone to my Mac on the morning of the big switch, and I do an encrypted backup because, let's face it, who wants to re-enter all those passwords? Not me. Anyway, once you get your new phone, before you can restore from your trusty backup in Finder, you have to go through a series of setup steps, entering your Wi-Fi password, iCloud credentials, Face ID, passcode, you know the drill. Now, if you're like me, you'll fly through these steps because you're eager to get to the good part, restoring from the backup. But here's where things get tricky. One of those steps asks, do you want to turn on stolen device protection? Naturally, you think, well, of course, I don't want my iPhone stolen. So you click yes without thinking much about it. Ah, but here's the trap. When you finally get to the step where you want to restore from backup, it asks you to turn off Find My, which is conveniently turned on by default. The problem? It's grayed out, and you can't turn it off. Why? Because, my friends, you have to first turn off stolen device protection, which, fun fact, won't let you do that for another 60 minutes.
Oh.
Now, while this is a brilliant security feature, if your device actually gets stolen, it's incredibly frustrating when you are just trying to set up your new phone. So there I was, sitting around for a solid hour, twiddling my thumbs and avoiding any more pits, waiting for that timer to run out. Moral of the story, when setting up your new phone, maybe hold off on turning on stolen device protection until after you've restored from your backup. You can always enable it later, minus the 60-minute wait.
Yeah.
You did an excellent job reading that novel. Thank you, Adam. You entertained the heck out of me. I've not turned this on. Have either of you turned this on your phones?
I have, and then I turned it off.
You didn't turn it right off, though, did you? You had to wait.
No, that's right. That's right. It just because it was one of those things. It just would never recognize that I was home, and it was a couple months. This is where I live. This is where the phone stays most of the time, and there's no way to force it. Hey, this is home. This is where I live. Seems to me you ought to be able to designate that up front. To start,
you don't get to pick that.
If there's a way to do it, I'm not aware of what it is.
If somebody knows, so. feedback@mackeycab.com.
You heard him.
Yeah.
Yep.
Huh. Weird. All right. Yeah. Well, you know, that's I haven't turned it on because I've heard all like I know that it. I know what it's set to do. Obviously. It's a good thing in general, but it's not. If you can't designate certain addresses, like I do know better than my phone about where I live.
Yep. Yeah. One last thing on Kirit's thing. I and maybe he can answer us. I'm curious if some of that was written by AI, because it was very entertaining. It was well written, so made reading it more entertaining.
You're a professional actor, Adam. Don't sell yourself short.
If any of that was AI written, though, but I'm just curious if.
Yeah.
So he can let us know.
Oh yeah, yeah, fair. Yeah, maybe. I mean, maybe Kieran's just a good writer. Like, it is possible. We are, you know,
Oh, of course.
Turns out we have humans.
Yeah, I don't mean to disparage his writing talents at all, but in this day and age, you have to start to wonder. Like,
it's fair. It is. It's interesting. Yeah. Well, Kira, let us know. We will not share any of your secrets, at least none of the ones that we haven't already shared. And we appreciate your tips. We appreciate everybody's tips. It's awesome. And that segment was Kirit's idea. So there you go. I love it. I want to take a minute and tell you about a podcast that we're doing a swap with. It's called Grumpy Old Geeks. And this isn't just another podcast with two old white guys talking about tech news, security, and entertainment and more. No. That's because occasionally there are three of them. That's right. And they've been podcasting for over a decade with more than 650 episodes. Brian and Jason have over 50 years of combined experience as internet industry pros, for whatever that's worth. They've seen the information superhighway go from the dream of a shining Star Trekian future to a William Gibson dystopian nightmare of legless virtual avatars in a cloud of BS and vaporware. They promised us a future of flying cars, but all we got was self-driving cars that are always 20 years away, corporate mass surveillance, and NFTs. There are many swears and feels, mostly grumpy, but hosts Brian, Jason, and sometimes Dave, this Dave, at least not as far as I know. Maybe there's Dave the avatar, the AI avatar. I don't know. Maybe. But sometimes Dave discuss what went wrong on the internet and who's to blame. Tune in every Saturday for a heaping helping of the real deal on our technological future and more. Go to GOG.show or search for Grumpy Old Geeks on your podcast platform of choice. And thanks to the guys over there for doing this swap with us. We always love these podcast swaps when we're able to do them with folks. So especially with a show that's a perfect fit like that, because people need more three old white guys talking about tech. It's like, I'm not kidding about this. I like it. It's good. It's also good and even better. I'll say even better is, are all of you who support us with our premium program at macgeekab.com/premium. It is very much appreciated. It is not mandatory, but it is very much appreciated and is a huge part of what allows us to do what we do. In the last couple of weeks, the following people have submitted, and I want to thank them. In the $25 range, we've had Craig from Costa Mesa, Thomas from Garden Grove, William from Gettysville, Graham from Glebe, Domenico from Holbrook, Andrew from Honolulu, Michael from Omaha, Bryn from Sun City, Mike from Tempe, Michael from Woodbine, and Fernando from Parts Unknown. We had a $20 contribution from Deke and a $15 contribution from Bob in Lepesh. And then $10 contributions from James in Amity Harbor, Bill in Parts Unknown, Jeff from Chesterton, I said that right, Barry from Des Plaines and elsewhere, Kevin from Edison, Paul from Lawrenceville, Joseph from Marietta, Corey from Lothian, Santiago from Palm City, Stephen from Plainfield, Jonathan from Plainsboro, Michael from Robbins. Can you tell that I alphabetized this by the city in which they live? Brian from Southbury, Frank from Tunbridge, Frank also from Voorhees. It's different Franks. Two different places. John from Wake Forest, Timothy from West Windsor. Thanks to all of you. And everyone who is in our premium program, we love you more than we're probably able to communicate. So thanks so much. And if you want to learn more about that, as I said, macgeekab.com/premium. Let's get to some questions, shall we? We've been excited about getting there. And we did it. We went through like 15 things and we still have time left.
Hitting it.
Woo!
Woo!
Hit and run. 10:57.
All right, Adam, you wanna bring us into Bruce here?
Yes.
Okay.
Another slight novel, but we'll get there.
Yeah.
Folks. Oh, he didn't call us gentlemen. Folks.
Yeah.
I'd like to react to the discussion. I'd like to react to the discussion at the end of MGG 1055 and the discussion of how often one changes their password. Bottom line up front, and maybe this is all we need to read. It's widely understood that changing passwords, except in the case where there's evidence of compromise, is detrimental to security. The U.S. National Institutes of Standards and Technology, NIST, recognized this and changed their recommendations in 2017 with the publication of Revision 3 to the NIST 800-63 Digital Identity Guidelines, and specifically Part B of that. Basically, what they discovered was that actually forcing a password change was detrimental to security. So that's old, old hat. You should not be forcing people to change their passwords.
Yeah.
Right.
Was there a question here, or was this a don't get caught thing?
Well, no, I think the question I had was like, I immediately was like, well, how could it be detrimental to change, to force changing your password? And so I dug into this a little bit and realized the problem is a couple things, but the main one is that it forces people to get more complacent about their how secure they make those passwords, because you're constantly having to remember them. And I know that I am guilty of this because my company still requires me to change my Outlook password every 90 days, or my Windows password, basically my what do they call the thing on Windows that you log in with? Blanking on the
Teams
name
or something, but like this, that.
The centralized like login system that drives all of Windows networking.
Microsoft Live or something, whatever it is.
It's the centralized password login system for corporate networks, and you everything in Windows connects to it. Remember anyway.
Someone tell us.
But they forced me to change my password every 90 days. So my password is now just these variants of something that I can remember. Now I use a long enough phrase, but basically what happens now is Active Directory. That's what it's called. So I just use my long passphrase and change the number on the end until I get to the point where, because they won't let you reuse it also for a certain number of days. So I just keep adding a number until then I go back, right? Which is really bad.
Sure.
Like, you know, and so I know that's part of this issue. In the same thing, they also say that you shouldn't be enforcing, other than password length, you shouldn't be enforcing any kind of, you have to have a number, you have to have an uppercase, you shouldn't have to do any of those rules either. You want to allow all of those things, but...
So it keeps it wide enough. You're actually limiting the number of possible passwords if you require.
Yeah, so what they do say is... You should have a minimum of 8, but really they say 16 is what it should be, but they're not forcing that in this sort of rule. But they recommend 16. They say at the very least it needs to be 8, and you should allow up to at least, I think they say 60. I'd have to go back and look, because that's another one that infuriates me, is like I've had banks and credit card companies that limit me to 20. Overall length, and I'm like, that's ridiculous.
Yep.
You're forcing me to have a less secure password by doing that. So, yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. And then my company, we have two-factor authentication with a third-party provider, and we still have to change our passwords every 90 days. It's driving me nuts.
Yeah.
I probably shouldn't admit here in front of God and everybody that you can't use your previous 4 passwords, so I changed my password 5 times.
that's actually really smart.
That's a good tip.
That is a good tip.
Skip back to the original.
I do. I go right
back. Change it. All right, now I can go back to my.
And now you got one you got a rotation. Want. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's another example of why this is bad to force this. If you have just a good initial secure password, you should not have to change it unless it's been compromised, right? That's the exception to this, so I want to be very clear about that.
Fair.
Right.
Force a password change when you have evidence of a compromise with that password. But the rules also go on to state that you really shouldn't be using single passwords in this day and age. You should have two-factor. You should have other mechanisms that are better security than just a single password. You know, if you're building a system, it shouldn't just be
right? And pass
and
keys
price password. Yeah. Yeah.
Pass keys are a coming. But and to their credit, they did change from 8 minimum to 12 minimum at work with I don't know if there's a maximum or not. I don't think there is.
I mean, there probably is.
Yeah. At some point, War and Peace is too many characters.
Yeah.
It should be sufficiently long, and it definitely shouldn't be restricted to 20, which is a common one I see.
Right.
And I don't know why anybody would limit it to 20.
Yeah.
So anyway,
interesting.
There you go.
Yeah. Interesting. I love these discussions.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. Right. Are we ready to move on to Deke? Is that where we're going there? Okay, great. Deke has, I need to find it, so I'm going to vamp here. I see it now. I found it. Hello, Dave, Adam, and Pete. I've been a listener since coming over with Adam, whose MacCast show I listened to for many years. Same, Deke. He says, I really enjoy the info and discussion from the three of you. Amazing. We love that. We aim to please. We really do. My question today, Deke continues, is about using a dedicated iPad in a common area of the house to access home automation apps. I have these apps on my phone, which is great for me, but my family members are not as interested. He says they would use an iPad sitting on a counter in the kitchen. I'd like to configure an iPad to access five or so home automation apps that control the lights, the blinds, the door locks, the thermostats, appliances, and cameras. Bonus, if it can also access music and podcasts to play through my HomePod minis. But of course, I don't want the iPad to access my email, my messages, my files, my calendars, my alerts, nor anything else personal. I am aware of iPad kiosk mode, but my reading suggests that this is to provide access to a single app, not a group of apps, and since my devices are not all HomeKit, I can't just leave it on one app. I also considered adding an extra Apple ID, but that doesn't seem to me like the right solution. Can you or your listeners suggest a good approach to meeting my goals? And I think I'm throwing this one to you, Pete, to begin the discussion.
Yeah, so all right, I think all of us had answers on this. So that was pretty cool. But first thing I came up with was, since you're the parent, as it were, of your device is the parent device in this account, set up screen time and block access to apps like mail, messages, files, calendars, and any other personal information that you want to block. And to do that, you go into settings and screen time and limit the apps there. Let's see what else I wrote. If you share an Apple ID with the iPad, ensure that the notifications like messages, mail, and personal data are not visible by disabling notifications for those apps under settings and notifications, which is why I actually have a separate ID for my work iPad, because I don't want my personal messages going to my company iPad.
Mm-hmm.
So I set up a separate Apple account, but he needs to be on the same account so it has his home, is the way I understood. That's the way I'm reading it. That's why I came up with that approach to it.
Yeah.
He needs to, that Apple ID, that app. Now it's called an Apple account, not an Apple ID. He needs Apple account to run his home. Yeah.
Really? It's not Apple ID anymore?
I think it's ubiquitous now.
Oh, you're right.
I think
it's
they're
Apple
trying
account.
To move it to call it Apple account. Yeah.
Wait. Oh, no. Here we have it. What is the difference between an Apple ID and an Apple account?
Yeah.
and it's exactly what you're saying. With the releases of iOS 18, iPadOS 18, macOS 15, and watchOS 11, Apple ID is renamed to Apple account for a consistent sign-in experience. Okay.
Mm.
Great. Thanks. Good to know.
Another quick tip.
Yep. Well,
but they probably still won't let you merge accounts if you have two. So.
Mm. No, not... Yeah, not without knowing somebody.
Is there
a
button?
Yeah. I've never been able to get it done. It's doable. It's got to be doable. Yeah, my thought on this was to just, I don't know why he doesn't want to use a separate Apple ID as part of his family, unless he's already at six and he can't add one. But if I were going to do this, I would add that, because an Apple ID can log into home. You can share your home with other Apple IDs. You can, for the third party apps, you can just log in with those accounts. That's fine. And then you can have music that's specific to that Apple ID. Like, it feels like that would be the solution if he has a slot.
Yeah.
But he said he didn't want to do that. So yeah. I'm not sure why.
Okay, that's why it didn't occur to me.
What do you think? Yeah, I didn't read that file. So, I was like, I know the answer, and I typed it before finishing reading. So,
I think Pete's answer is probably if you don't want to do the separate Apple ID thing. So I'm accepting that caveat up front. So I'm be clear about
so
that.
So stipulated.
Yeah, I think screen time is the right thing. And I was like, when this came up, I was like really curious about this because they're like, I think you could do this with screen time. It turns out it's kind of actually tricky to do, but I think you can achieve exactly this. There's just some details in terms of like what Pete was describing that I think are important to point out. So when you go into settings, screen time, what you're going to want to do is go into the restrictions, content and privacy restrictions, turn those on, and then there's a bunch of them, including like access to install apps, delete apps, purchase apps. You're going to want to disallow that probably on this iPad so people can't put other apps, like, because he wanted just a set of apps. So you'd want to set up the iPad as new, install just the apps that you want on that iPad, or in terms of the third-party apps, I'm talking about the HomeKit apps, then disable being able to download or install any new apps. And then also under allowed apps and features, this is the core iOS apps. You can turn off things like Mail, Safari, FaceTime, a lot of the built-in apps, access to the stores and podcasts and news. That's all built-in apps. And then I think that would basically cover it. You would also want to go in and disallow access to contacts, calendars, reminders. And I think that would then stop any of that from being accessible. The only thing there that I wonder about is if you had automations that needed data from calendars, contacts, or reminders, I don't know what would happen there. So you'd probably have to play around with those settings a little bit. But I mean, you can turn, basically disallow everything and lock that whole iPad down. Now, the last thing you want to make sure you do is in the screen time settings, scroll all the way to the bottom and make sure share across devices is turned off.
Oh.
So that these settings only apply to that iPad and don't screw up everything else on all your other devices. So that's probably a very important setting to check, maybe even first before you start setting all these things up.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't bury the lead.
But I think that would effectively lock that device down. Like, you wouldn't be able to install new apps on it. You wouldn't be able to access Mail, contacts, calendars. You would only have access to the apps that were installed on there. And then you set a passcode on the screen time settings so that only you could change those settings, right?
Right.
So that would effectively lock that iPad down, I think, in the way that they're looking for.
I agree. I like this solution. Yep. I feel like, does anybody out there do this? Because this is one of those things where you want it to be locked down. You want your data to not be the data that you deem private, you want not to be accessible to other people. But it is accessible to someone who knows how to get into that iPad, right? And so where is the hole? Have we plugged all of the holes, right? And which one is left unplugged that would cause a problem down the road? Like, that's my only concern about this, which is why I like the idea of a second account, because then it's like the hole is fully plugged. I can't think of what that hole is. I think you've plugged all of them, but that's the problem, is the unknown unknowns.
Right. Yep. Yeah. I mean, the second account I think is much easier potentially.
Yeah.
But again, you're still going to want to lock down like installing other apps if your intent is like, you're still going to have to go some like to sit, add the screen time protections and at least not let somebody go and install, you know, another app that they want to install. If your true intent is, I want this to be a kiosk like device that can't get messed with.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't do multi apps, iPad kiosk mode. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you can't. No. Yeah. And the other thing about this that's important to point out is the app settings, the app restriction settings for screen time are only a select set of apps. I don't know why that is. It's not, you can't just go in and disable third-party apps. So you have to pre-set up the apps and then disable the ability to install any more apps on the device.
So
it's a weird.
There are some MDM solutions that
will
let you do multi-app kiosk mode. Right? Because it, like, I'm finding Hexnode will do it, and Intune IRL will do it. So there's got to be multi-app kiosk mode solutions. Like, there is a way to do it. So could you use Apple Configurator to create a profile that did effectively limited your use to one of, you know, a series of apps? And then that way it is in kiosk-like mode, locked down with a profile. I'm
sure you could do that.
Well, we're finding some things. There was a discussion in our Discord. It's not coming to me what the topic was right away. There was something about, I'll find it, where you had to do it with an MDM. You could not do it with a profile with Apple Configurator. It is... this only works now. I just got to find out what it is.
I mean, because corporations do this all the time, yes. Right? You have a sales staff, and it's like you get these apps, and that's it. You know,
yeah,
on your iPad because you're on the floor and you're just selling stuff or whatever.
It's the every 30-day pop up that we talked about. You can disable it with an MDM. But not with a profile that you create with Apple Configurator. You have to do it with an MDM. So it's possible that this multi-app mode is the same way. I don't know. But that one, it's pretty explicit. It says it only works if the profile is delivered via MDM. No manually installing this key. So, yeah.
Weird.
It's weird. Yeah, yeah. I'm not sure why that would be the case. But anyway. We still have a little bit more time. We have some great questions here. So I want to ask Erica's question of you, Adam. Good morning, gentlemen. Oh boy, we're in trouble now. There's a gentleman here. The other morning, on a Wednesday morning, I was able to send a text message to my husband at a later time in the morning using the send later feature in presumably iOS 18, but I think it's in the other operating systems too. How is it, then, that I wasn't able to do it on Sunday? Is it only for Apple phones, or can I send to any type phone? Is there a catch? What am I missing? Thank you, says Erica. And as always, I love the show.
Yep. And I struggled with this, too, because I had not tried this feature, and I was like, how do I do this? So, you know, of course, I head to Google and find the Apple support article, and it says it should work with anything, because basically the way the feature works is it works through iCloud. It sends a encrypted message to Apple servers, which is stored there until it's sent and then removed from the server. So if you're using iOS 18, iPadOS 18, macOS Sequoia, watchOS 11, or VisionOS 2, you should have this feature. What I couldn't figure out, it was like how to activate it. I was like, where is this thing? So when you're in messages, you just hit the little plus. You have to apply send later first, and then it gives you a little thing in your message box that lets you set up the send later options. And then you type your message, and then you send it.
Got it. All right. Okay. Oh, wait. You set it up before you send your message?
Correct. You have to say, I intend to send. Yeah, you have to click the little plus button next to your message dialog box, and then you'll see the option for send later. Also location.
But yeah, wait, I was able to type the message first and then click the plus button.
Oh, okay. So you can add it at any time.
Yeah.
Okay. But I had expected it to be like, I was doing the whole tap and hold thing.
Same.
You know, like, I'm looking for something to pop up like in the message box, and it's not there. You have to access it like you would an app.
Yeah,
basically.
Yeah. Oh, that's a clunky UX. Okay. Thank you for going through that. So I would not have. I mean, I would have stumbled on it eventually, I'm sure. But great, sweet. Larry has a question. Larry says, "So wait a minute. I'm entrusting all of my valuable data to SSD drives, but, and he's talking about this product called Lifespan from Micromat, which tells you how much lifespan is left on your SSD, right? He says, but now Micromat's telling me that they these drives have a lifespan. I know a good backup strategy is to have redundant copies, and I do. But Larry continues and says, I was hoping that my trusty SSD would last forever. It doesn't seem like there are a lot of moving parts. Should I buy into this fear and get this product? Anybody want to take this? I'm happy to take it, but you want to take it, Adam?
Well, I hate to burst this bubble, but guess what? All media has a lifespan.
Yep.
Record albums did. Cassette tapes did. CDs do, if you damage them enough. CDs might be a little more permanent, but they will rot too eventually. Like, it's plastic. They're not lasting forever. The surfaces and stuff. So, I mean, the reality is everything is going to die eventually. But SSDs, you know, they have a certain number of write cycles, and depending upon how they're used and, you know, the lifespan's going to. So that's what this tool is meant to tell you. Chances are you're going to move your data and replace that SSD long before it reaches its lifespan. I mean, most people are. You're going to get a new computer. You're going to upgrade. You're going to. So, yeah, I mean, I've talked about this with archival storage, right? If you think that you're going to take that drive out and sit it on a shelf for 200 years and be able to come back and get the data back off of it, you've got multiple problems. One, the data could probably just rot. Two, you're probably not going to have, at that time, the right kind of interface to plug it into. Like, I have SCSI drives that I'm sure are sitting in a box somewhere. I can't connect them probably to anything today. Maybe I could cobble something together and get them connected, but like, good luck getting the data. And even if the data was good, you know, so like, it's one
you
of these problems that, yes,
while, so.
Yes, they will wear out. Is it going to be a problem for you? Probably not. You're probably either going to have some other problem, like you can't actually connect the drive anymore, or and you didn't move the data. So it's important with archival backups. If you want to keep stuff digitally for forever, you have to keep moving it. You have to put it in multiple locations. You have to do the work to save it.
Yeah. Which, interestingly enough, I got an email yesterday and I was like, oh, yeah. Steve Gibson has a product called SpinRite. Ah, but it's not a spinning drive, you say. You're right, it's not. And I haven't figured out yet how to do this with a Mac. That being said, I used SpinRite back when I was a Windows geek, but he's updated the 6.1. And he said, SpinRite restores SSD performance. The biggest surprise in developing this, he said, was discovering that even solid-state mass storage could benefit from SpinRite's rewriting of its media due to, quote, redisturb, quote, unquote, SSD and flash storage slow down when they are only read and never written, which affects most operating system files. People say that their SSD-based laptops no longer perform as well as they once did. Now we know why. During the 3.5 years of work on 6.1, I discovered that SpinRite could restore the SSD to original factory performance.
What? Okay. Now, I know I upgrade the operating system on my Mac once a year, so maybe that's enough.
That it's writing,
You know, but that's why, and I'm, like, if someone has an answer, great, but otherwise I'm just sort of, you know, pondering here. Why would something that's written to a cell on the SSD be slower to read from 3 months from now, or 12 months, however many months, but a period of time from now than it is today? That
he's calling it redisturb. It's somehow it's disturbing it or degrading it or whatever. So grabbing it and rewriting it is essentially going, okay, now it's new data. It's
You know, I believe him. Yeah. I believe Steve. Yeah. I'm curious as to why. That's all. It's not a lack of trust.
SpinRite 6.1 to work on a Mac. It doesn't. It needs its own bootable DOS system.
SpinRite has never, as far as I know, has never run on a Mac. Like it doesn't. You need a Windows machine.
You do. And then the other problem is once you've got it running there, how do you connect your internal flash drive of your Mac to make it work. That, you know, that's a problem to be solved. It can be done.
Can it? You'd have to do target the target mode.
Yeah, target thing. Disk mode.
And, yeah. Yeah, you're right.
And but he's coming out with Spinrite 7 at some point in the future. Of course, it only took 10 years, I think, to get 6 to 6.1.
6 to 6.1.
when he said he was going to start working on it. Well, that's when he started working on Squirrel, which is similar to Passkey.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And so my thing on all of this is, okay, how much degradation are we talking about and over how long? Because again, like, I'm probably getting a new laptop before this really becomes a problem for me. Right. You know what I'm saying? Like,
right. Oh yeah.
Are we creating mental problems where it's just like, again, I don't need the highest throughput performance. Of course. Yeah. Like at a base level, I get this, but how many people are obsessing over, you know, their read write speeds to that degree? No, not me. I really don't care. Honestly,
I'm pointing for those now. For those listening, I'm pointing at Dave.
I'm at a point in my life where I do not care. Like, I don't run, you know, benchmarks on my SSDs the minute I get them. And I know people do. And they're like, I've gotten emails from people. They're like, I don't understand because it's rated for this and it's not getting this. I have never double checked on my things. My computer works. Yeah. It runs the things I need to do. It's plenty fast. Like, I'm not worrying about it on a day-to-day basis, to be honest.
All right, so
with you.
Guys, right? I Adam, I know you've been reading long things in this episode. I just have one more for you. It's a paper published at the Association for Computing Machinery. I'm not going to have you read this, but it is about mitigating the negative impacts of read disturb in SSDs. And it starts by saying read disturb. So those are two words, just for anybody that was wondering how it was spelled, like I was, is a circuit level noise in solid state drives, which may corrupt existing data in SSD blocks and then cause high read error rate and therefore longer read latency. The approach of read refresh is commonly used to avoid read disturb errors by periodically migrating the hot read data to other free blocks, but it places considerable negative impacts on IO responsiveness while it's doing it. Okay. All right. So you can, that's just some light reading for you folks if you're having trouble getting to sleep at night.
But, so yeah, this feels like a fix for the SSD industry. Like, why wouldn't you just make your SSDs kind of sort of
garbage collection system? Yes. Yeah. Wow.
Optimize your hard drive. Like, remember the old spinning?
Well, I mean, even with SSDs, like, there's Trim, which is the operating system telling the SSD, you've got time now, go and do some of your garbage collection. So maybe there's Trim version 2 or something that does this read. We have to remember, SSDs are relatively new. I mean, this show has been in existence for 20 years, right? Or almost 20 years. I know, Adam, not quite yet. Your show was in existence for 20 years. This one hasn't hit that number yet. No, you hit 19 or you hit 20?
19.
Okay, 19. Right. So that's right. Okay. But yeah, we're in our 20th year. And SSDs were one of the first sort of major technological shifts that happened during this show's lifespan. Like, when I first got my first SSD and replaced the internal drive in my laptop, I mean, it was like I had discovered fire, as we all did when we went through that. I mean, it wasn't me, it wasn't just me, but you know, they are that, which means that this is a technology certainly that has been in existence for a long time, but in terms of mass commercial use, basically a decade. And so we don't really know about the longevity of these things. Certainly, I've seen SSDs die, especially the first gen of them. But they do die. And when they die, it is unceremonious death for the SSD. Like, there's no getting it back. It just goes offline. It doesn't even show up as a drive anymore. Right. So, you know, you definitely want to have backups of your SSDs. And we learned that early on. It's not like you get, well, it's starting to have problems, so you better get your data. Nope. Nope, this is a binary thing, folks.
The switch is off.
The switch is now off. Yeah, good luck. You can bake it in the oven, but it's not going to make a difference. But we don't know. Because we don't have enough collective mass market experience with these things, we're starting to get to that point. So, you know, to go back to Larry's sort of initial question that he didn't quite ask, but he sort of did, do you need an app like Lifespan from Micromat? I mean, do you need it? No, it falls into that the more you know category, right? If you know your SSD is at 60%, man, that's probably way past time to replace it. You know, you're if it's 70% or below, I mean, they probably have some guidance in the app too, but my gut says, oh yeah, like it should be 70s, 80s, 90s, and then you're fine.
And the prices have come down so much. That's the beauty of it. Can you just go? Remember, you know, 100 gigabyte SSD drive was hundreds of dollars, if not thousands, back when
Now
still
we've got...
is if you're buying it from Apple.
Yeah, they're pricing on
boom. Maybe mic drop.
Wait a minute, Adam. You just answered the question because earlier we were saying why is Apple's cloud storage so expensive? It's because they're buying their own SSDs from themselves.
That's it.
Yeah, we should send Tim a link to Amazon. Maybe he can, you know, get a deal. Yeah.
Talk about snakes eating their own tail, huh? Oh, boy.
$200 for $30 worth of SSD. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, we have succeeded in burning up our time, which I knew.
And yours.
We would.
You're welcome, folks.
Oh, man. For a while, it felt like time was proceeding very slowly in this episode. And then suddenly we got into this discussion. And it was like, boom, there we are. We are now finished. Yeah. Thanks to all of you for sending in everything, for listening. We say it all the time, but this show is a community, and I would say it is a community like no other, and I am every day so grateful to be a part of this. So thank you all, every one of you, and it's amazing. Make sure to check out our monthly giveaway at macgeekab.com/giveaway. That URL is always good once the month changes and the giveaway, you know, changes to the new one, macgeekab.com/giveaway. There you go. Points to the new one. Brings you there. I can't tell you yet what it's going to be for October, but you can find out before I will. Well, wait, I think I already know. It's just a secret. You know, fun. Thanks to Cashfly for providing all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. Check out Pete's other show, So There I Was, if you like. Check out my other shows, Gig Gab and Business Brain, if you like. Send us a review. I meant to read the reviews. We got two reviews from Canada this week, which is great.
Nice.
We would love some reviews from other countries. So if you're in Canada, you folks are up. Keep it going. And if you're in another country like the U.S. or Turkey or Afghanistan or, you know, Australia or Germany, send us a review. You could be the one. We'll read them on the show. We'll read them next episode. Thanks for hanging out with us, everybody. So much fun. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Adam.
Yes, sir.
Do you have any lasting advice to give everyone?
Yeah. Next time you're taking 4 iPads into Mexico, don't get caught.
Made on a Mac.